Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Enterprise Dish. We are hanging out with the Ohio boys, for better, for worse. It is January. Rick is back. He's in Columbus, although he hasn't been there very long, at least this month. Rick, how is it going?
Well, Brad and listeners, yeah, cheers. Happy 2020. I have had a very busy first part of the year, and in fact, that's quite a story in itself. I started the year January 4th, flew out to Shanghai, China. For our internal kickoff, I did three kickoffs, right? I went to Shanghai, Prague, and Atlanta for Veeam stuff. And, you know, for those of you that might not know what I mean by a kickoff, it's like, what is it, a football game? What is he talking about? Companies that have very distributed sales marketing type people around the world, they usually pool them all together. Mm-hmm. At the start of a year, or sometimes a quarter or mid-year, depending on how their company's structured, and basically give them their, you know, annual inoculation of corporate information.
Yep.
And went out to the market and do what they need to do in that market. So I did that for all three of our regions around the world, presented some training, some sessions, and it was a very, very busy 3 weeks. But the beautiful thing, Brad, Thursdays, I got to come home each week. So,
oh, that's nice.
From China, came home Thursday. From Prague, came home Thursday. From Atlanta, came home Thursday. So it wasn't 21 straight days gone. Mm-hmm. But you might notice my voice is a little raspy. I was in China.
Mm-mm-mm.
Yeah, I called my doctor because I'm like, I have this cold flu. It just won't go away. By the way, I went to China earlier this month. You know what they told me?
What?
Go straight to the emergency room at a full-blown hospital with a lab. That was like mortifying. I'm like, whoa, this news, this situation about the coronavirus, they're taking it pretty seriously. So they had a number of questions for me and a number of tests, but no, I don't have that. But I have, you know, plain old bronchitis. So,
you know, it's one of those rare times you're like, thankfully, yes. Rick only has bronchitis.
Yeah, it's exactly. So, but no, it was actually kind of stressful. And sure. So I was kind of concerned. And, you know, thoughts go out to all the people around the world, as well as the people in the Wuhan city that are dealing with this, this virus situation. Because I was talking to the medical professionals at the hospitals, and, you know, they even had an infectious disease doctor come in and talk to us. It's very interesting how they handle those situations. And just to give you a perspective, Brad, I walked into the emergency room, and I don't know if you've ever been to an ER, but it's like picking the line at the grocery store. I never pick the right time or the right, you know, place, whatever. I walk into this emergency room, there's people everywhere. And I'm thinking, oh, I'm going to be here all night. I told them, hi, my doctor said I should go to the ER. I have cold flu symptoms, and I've been to China. My doctor wouldn't even see me.
Mm-hmm.
They said go straight to the ER. They then called the ER and gave them like a heads up that I'm coming. Yeah. It kind of pre-checked me in. I was back in a room being tested in 4 minutes.
Wow.
I was in and out of there after imaging tests and everything in like 90 minutes. They treated it so professionally, so rapidly, and not rushed. But they once I said that, they kicked into a different mode and treated it differently. And so, I guess to the listeners, if you're ever on the edge on, you know, medical treatment, you know, when it makes sense, do the right thing. And
sure,
I got real lucky with it, so that was nice.
Well, yeah, no, that actually is really nice. I mean, that's. Yeah. That's actually, you know, that's a good story, right? It's the right thing to do. And now, you know, now you don't have to worry about it for that matter.
Well, the alternative was if I was either positive or not clear, because there's a middle if you're not sure. Like if they were not sure if I had it or not, they would have put me in quarantine.
Yep.
And I didn't know they had that at this hospital, right? So we might have been doing this podcast a little bit differently today if that was the case.
A little bit, but other things you hopefully don't have to worry about, Mr. Rick, is hopefully you're not running server 2008 R2, because if you are, you've got different things to be worrying about right now. Well, I guess you could still be worrying about a virus at this point.
A different type of virus, but yeah. So, you know, I've been trying to advocate to people a long time about what to do about 2008 R2. I realize there are, I think I can say this on this show, craplications that are just really fiddlesome, right? You don't know what's going to break when you think about the thought of changing the OS is mortifying. So I realize that those are out there, but I'll lay out, let's go with three options in different levels of amount of difficulty to sort out this problem. Now, this is kind of, you know, I love Azure and I love Microsoft, but just FYI to the listeners, if you have 2008 R2, if you migrate that workload to Azure, you get 3 more years of upgrades and updates, I should say. I think that's a great technique to commit to everyone, we're going to migrate off. But actually just migrating to Azure is a difficulty in itself. I know with like a Veeam backup, I can restore right to Azure. So that's great. That's one option. And it actually, we kind of fell into this problem the hard way. I'm not quite sure how to verbalize it, but that's one bad thing about having virtualized platforms, especially if you think about on-premises data centers. Mm-hmm. The thing about VMs is they can run forever. You're basically running a museum of legacy operating systems on these things. There's no real pressure because you can migrate it to newer hardware. Whereas if we had older hardware, we would be in a forcing function of having to do something to modernize the platform. So, yay, VMware Hyper-V, thanks. But the reality is that this OS burden doesn't go away. Mm-hmm. Now, I want to throw you a curveball, Brad, because I'm gonna step on the Veeam soapbox, but you know, based on the camera livery here, it's pretty clear I'm in a Veeam office. I wrote a paper on this because I think it's really important. But with the end of support, I wrote this, I guess, almost a year ago. But the thought is I wanted to give people awareness to a technique you can do to modernize the operating system. So a lot of people don't know this, but let's say if you have a 2008 R2 system that's a virtual machine, VMware or Hyper-V, I can take a backup of it with Veeam. And then I can spin up that backup in a virtual lab. And a virtual lab is an isolated copy, isolated environment. And if I need other things like a domain controller or a database server or a web server, I can do that as well. Take a backup of them, put them in the virtual lab. And I did some research, just me, okay? And I didn't play with every craplication that's out there. But I actually... You ever just put in the new Windows CD and it says upgrade?
Yeah.
Do you know most of the time that actually works? I'm serious. It does. So my thought here is give that a try in something like a virtual lab. Mm-hmm. On production systems, that's mortifying, right? You don't know what's going to happen or maybe there'll be a problem. But I went through that drill with some installations I had and it just worked. And upgrade, the first option inside of the Windows CD, right? But the thought is test it in a virtual lab. And that way you'll know exactly what's going to happen in production. And if you need to test it with a database, test it with Windows clients, test it with anything, you can do it in that virtual lab, save all that experimentation for the virtual lab so that when you go do it in production, you don't have any surprises. And the third recommendation with 2008 R2, and this is a hard one, it's probably time to change the app, you know? Yeah. I talked to companies with NT systems still running their business. Yeah. And I say to them, I'd love to be able to come up with a backup solution for you, but I actually think you have bigger problems than backup, you know? And I think that when you think about, let's drop in one buzzword, only one buzzword, digital transformation. If an organization properly transforms digitally, you know, there's an inherent requirement for that platform to do what they need to do to run their business. And if you think about legacy, really, really legacy application operating system platforms, it's not in alignment. So the hard work of changing the app is probably one of the things that need to happen. So three different paths, three different levels of advice, but this is real. I mean, the easy one is up into Azure, but then you got to learn connectivity and there might be, you know, might require a physical system. Sometimes that's not an option, but I realize there's a lot of work and a lot of legacy systems out there. I mean, I think you can buy the extended support there's probably got to be somebody that's figured out a way to hack out the Windows updates in Azure to make them uninstallable and transportable. But I don't know. I don't want to do that.
Yeah,
but
that's, I'm sure it's possible. I'm sure somebody has figured it out. But do you really want to do that?
No.
Especially in like a high value production environment.
Yeah. So, I mean, that was a big milestone. Everybody knew it was coming, right? That should not be a surprise to anyone. But I think that this is also a catalyst. Okay, let's start thinking about our 2012 systems, right? I think that is in 2024, 2023 or something like that. Microsoft very clearly publishes those dates on when systems are going to go offline from the extended support. So, you know, let this be a catalyst, right? 2008 R2 was a big year. Actually, it was, if you go back to when 2008 and 2008 R2, there was a big milestone. Do you remember what that difference was?
No, I don't. It's been a while. About the
big
11
difference,
years.
Yeah, it has been a while. But the big difference was 2008 was the last 32-bit OS.
Oh, you're right.
Yeah. And then 2008 R2 required it to be 64-bit. So there was this really interesting window. So I actually think there's a lot of 2008 still out there too, which is deprecated even earlier. 2008 was really special because it could be a 32-bit OS, and it had to then be limited to 4 gigs of RAM just because it couldn't go above. Same thing on desktop platforms. So that was a very interesting time if you put yourself back in 2007, 8, 9, 10 on what IT administrators and servers thought about as a priority, as the right platform for installations and stuff. So there's a lot of 2008 R2, I'm sure, still out there. I love one of the, let's see, what's the right, most colorful Microsoft personalities, Ned Pyle, he's Nerd Pyle on Twitter. He likes to share what he finds in telemetry data. And he'll say, here's an NT system, here's a Windows 2000 system, here's a 2003 system. He's very transparent in sharing about that. But I'm pretty sure there's a lot of 2008 R2 still there.
Would not surprise me.
I've been rambling a lot, Brad. Sorry about that. I had my good coffee this morning. Here in Columbus, we have, so I'll give a shout out to the Canadians.
Tim Hortons is making its way down south.
Oh, it's been in Columbus for a good 20 years, right?
Wow, we don't have it in Cincinnati yet.
You used to. You Did still we? Do. Yeah, like it's not quite working there. But it's selectively in certain markets in the U.S., it's good coffee and it's good price. I'm not trying to make it a commercial, but like I'm amped from the coffee is what I'm getting at.
Some good brew. Some good brew on this on this morning. Well, Rick, we got a couple questions in actually since we talked last. And so we'll dive into the first one here. It says, what does Rick, or what do you do differently for endpoint backup versus server backup? How do you think about those differently?
Oh, well, the big difference is you can't make it a hardware decision, right? So what I mean by that is just because it's a Surface or a ThinkPad or something like that, that actually doesn't mean it's a workstation or a laptop, because what matters, it's the application. And I say that very specifically because you can't just say, oh, all ThinkPads, all Surfaces, all whatever other, you know, form factors we have for historically end user compute devices, those are workstations. And let me explain why. Take a retail or a robo office. There may be situations where IT decides, well, you know, it doesn't make sense to put a server in the edge. That's a fancy word for remote and retail situations. Maybe I'll put this server application on a power workstation, like a ThinkCenter, right? The thought is, well, there's a SQL database. It runs on Windows 10, no problem. It's the app that makes the difference. So I always want to preface it that the application profiles, plural, makes the difference between, is it a workstation backup profile or a server backup profile? Because I look at doing backups on the server side as the applications, because if I'm backing up a workstation, this device I'm talking to you now on, I don't need application consistency. I don't need to calm down SQL. I don't need to prune Exchange logs. I don't need to tell Oracle that I'm getting ready to do a backup. But if I have a PC at a retail location, that has the clock in, clock out system, making stuff up here, mm-hmm. that has a SQL database, well, that might be different. Maybe I'll need to back that system up with application consistency and log truncation and things like that, and have more granular recovery, like bring that database back to a mm-hmm. point in time. So always think about that, meaning that's the most important oversight, because a lot of times big data exists in small places, or, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. not all data is in the data center, whatever you might want to sure. say. So that's one consideration, is look at the application profile. Now, back to then, aside from that, traditional workstation, traditional server, obviously with a workstation, you can't, you know, do, I don't think we have technology yet to do image-based backups that are agentless, right, on a mm-hmm. workstation. So, you know, a good way to start is using the Veeam Community Edition with free 10 instances of Windows and Linux backup. And then the other side of that is on servers, you could do image-based, agent-based backups, or if there's a virtual platform, we could look at agentless image-based backups. But I keep using that phrase, image-based. Whether or not it's agentless, I think that's a really important thing, because that really is going to help you recoverability-wise. Otherwise, sure. you're redeploying a new system, putting in the applications, and bringing data back. So the number one principle is determine if there's an application profile that determines server handling, which is irregardless of OS and hardware. And then the second consideration, which is consideration of OS and hardware, is to think about seeking an image-based backup. And then also think about, you know, how much retention, right? I think that PCs and laptops for traditional end-user profiles, mm-hmm. you don't need to keep it for 7 years. You know, the 3 to 4 to 5 restore points are probably adequate. I for data center type stuff, you know, talk to your business and understand what the requirements are. If you can't get an answer, go to finance, go to legal. And if you still can't get an answer, keep as much as you can, right? Because that becomes a different consideration. And then you have to start thinking about the cloud, right? The last, back to the PC endpoint device backup conundrum, one little trick that I like to do, and this is in the free Veeam agent for Windows, is you can actually do a backup, an image-based backup, and there's an option to eject the media once the backup is done. So if you're going external hard drive, mm-hmm. so it's immediately offline mm-hmm. in case there's a ransomware situation later, that USB drive isn't attached to the local file system. So those are some tips off the top of my head. And then the other thing is just keep in mind your recovery options. You know, one of the things, in fact, I did this just at home, Brad. I have my ThinkCenter or ThinkPad. Mm-hmm. I have the one before this. I actually took a Veeam agent backup and I restored it onto a new SSD that was bigger. So it's like you can use backups as migration tools, right? So take a backup, restore it to the bigger and faster SSD, or take a backup of the old computer, restore it as a virtual machine and just leave it there forever in case I needed it. Don't sit this old hardware on my desk forever in case I need something off of it. Throw it in as a virtual machine, power it on as I need it, pluck out the files, that type of thing, right? So think about your backup software as helping you more on a lifecycle play, migration play. That's the last piece of advice. And boy, I'm chatty today.
It's all good, Rick. It's all good. It's all good. I mean, the thing is like, that's good advice though. Like why hold back when it's genuine advice that's going to help the people and specifically the person that asked the question. So it's...
Yeah. Okay. Well, there you go. Good. Question McQuestion face. I hope your question is answered.
We got another question in too, and I definitely have a take on this, but I'm curious to see how you approach it. This individual writes and says, we have our first IT audit coming up in the history of our company. Any advice on what to look for or how to prepare?
Okay. We're going to take it here. Yeah. So, you know, a lot of people don't know this, but before Veeam, I actually worked in the financial services industry. So mm-hmm. I went through this quite a bit. I want to first drop a mindset, an audit. What is it? It's a review. Mm-hmm. Okay. And the if you work backwards to why do you audit, it's likely, if it's in a regulated situation, it might be as part of a compliance journey, mm-hmm. or it's part of an, if it's not required for a compliance journey, it might be an investigative audit. Like example, you've bought X amount of software. Are you using X amount of software? Or that type of thing. Mm-hmm. So I'll give you a few pieces of advice on both ends of the perspective. From a compliance perspective, I don't know why I should probably have put this in a tweet and maybe everybody would agree with it, but it's one of those things that getting compliance on a product is a result of two things: how it's implemented and how it's audited. Mm-hmm. Okay. What I mean by that is, let's just pick a product. Let's pick two products, say Windows Server 2019, and let's just say Microsoft Azure, the whole thing. By itself, those products are or are not necessarily compliant. It's how you implement them. Example, turning Windows Firewall off on an Azure VM in the cloud, allowing the resource group connection to everything on the internet, and having Windows Server with no password. Mm-hmm. Chances are you will not pass an audit with that deployment. So how it's implemented, right? And then how it's audited. So again, but if you lock down, use like Azure Blueprints, for example, the Azure Blueprints have very specific recommendations for resources in Azure when you go through, say, a PCI audit, a HIPAA audit, and then the UK DHI audit, for example, and a couple other relatively common standards-based things. So check out those Azure Blueprints. The other side of it is on-premises, you can find a lot of this, you know, in white papers and stuff. And the other part is, you can always justify a potential disparity as an exception somehow. There might be a business reason for it. Mm-hmm. There might be a technical accommodation made for it. A lot of times I had, in my experience, from a security perspective for an audit, I had things that weren't so good for the security people. So what did I do? We put it on isolated networks. And when I mean an isolated network, I mean an isolated network. Okay, it's not connected to anything, right? So, you know, there you'd have to follow through a lot of different systems to get to whatever you're looking at, and, you know, no out-of-band access, those types of things, right? So there's always accommodations you can make, and you can always put those as things to improve. And you should always come out of an audit with things to improve. From an investigative audit standpoint, the other thing I should note is just be accurate with that. Never incorrectly state. And in fact, it's better to say you don't know on something and it needs to be investigated than make up an answer that you think is at least right or could be more or less correct. Always, you know, if you don't know, don't know, and say you need to find out. I'll give you an example of my professional experience, because I think it's very important that people take the investigative audit pretty seriously. Hewlett-Packard, now HPE, I like them, good people, no doubt. I had a software installation audit that was going on, and there was a long list of questions that came through. This was more investigative than it was compliance driven. And there was a question, and I don't remember the question. I really apologize for that, but the answer is what mattered. I said, I am using HPE Data Protector Express, period.
Yep.
And that is actually a free product that at the time came with tape drives. So if you bought an HP tape drive, you got a copy of Data Protector Express just to use it, to interact with it.
Gotcha.
Now that's a free software, but I had the question, and literally I got the call from HP or whoever was doing my audit. And I said, yep, it's the free one that came with. I'll show you the console. I'll show you the logs. And, you know, it's the right thing to do, right? Mm-hmm. It goes a lot farther, I think, when you're fully transparent and fully accurate. And if you don't know, say you don't know, and don't put yourself or your organization, or more importantly, your data, into a situation that, you know, you're not correctly represented, right? So all of that being said, I would recommend that you just go in truthfully and willing to work with it. Audits are not something to be afraid of or scared of, but they're also not fun either. You know, you still have regular work to do, I'm sure, but you'll be okay.
Yeah, as somebody who used to be on the other side, I used to perform IT audits at Cypher from an internal and external perspective. The one thing.
Really?
Yeah, I used to be an IT auditor. That's kind of how this world blended together a little bit. I worked for a consulting firm, and we would go in either as an internal, like they would hire us to do an internal audit, or they would hire us to do like a compliance audit or whatever. The one piece of advice I give everybody is don't take it personally, because people that come in and say, hey, look, this isn't how it should be configured and get offended, have a bad time. It's not meant to be an attack on your work ethic, workload, your environment. It's just when you're doing an audit, you are given a list of things you're expected to test. And then there's also a list of best practices for those things you're expected to test. And if they don't align up, you get an exception or you get a report. You can argue any single one of them as much as you want. Just pick your battles wisely. And most people, like 99.9% of people, come out on the other side of an IT audit just fine. Yep. It's to Rick's point, when somebody comes out and says, oh yeah, we only have one admin account, and then you sign off on it, and then they run the scan, and oh, there's 17 admin accounts that you get into, and they all have the same password, and they're all used by individual people, and you're not using a proper path. Just be honest. Like, people aren't there to, you're not going to get, again, 99.9% of the time, I don't think anybody I ever audited end up getting like fired over something. Like, it never happens. Unless you're lying to protect yourself or something that's poorly run on the other side. So
you bring up a good point, because it's very important to be as accurate as possible, because if there's a scan involved, that tells all.
Oh, right? And let me tell you, that was the easiest part of the audit, because we would have a machine. I don't even know what they look like anymore, because this is 10 years ago. You go in, you get access to the network. Some companies wouldn't provide access, so you can still do it externally. And before we'd even show up, we would have just thousands of pages of logs that would show open ports, accounts, and all sorts of stuff. So you don't want to try to hide things, because regardless of whether you survive that 5 minutes of looking, it will eventually show up.
I guess one more piece of advice came up, and that's, you know, don't be in the same position next time. If you have an audit now, chances are they're going to be back next year or some other subsequent amount of time. If you can display progress time over time, that's very powerful. Don't go the wrong way.
Yeah. Right. Right, but especially in that scenario, auditors will give you the benefit of the doubt. Like, if you can make a justified argument why you have three admin accounts, you know, there is room for pushback. Like, it's not that you can only have one admin account per network. That's not how the world works. We know that. But to your point, if you show progress that you're going the right direction, people will give you benefit of the doubt that you're actively trying to improve. And they're more likely to be more lenient and sign off on things, because they know that in the next 2 months, you are going to materially improve your whatever instance or issue that cropped up.
Indeed, indeed.
So, well, Rick, as we wrap it up here in the back of the book, what else is going on in your world? Anything else? And then
Veeam's about ready to drop version 10. I'm actually looking any minute now for the release that goes out to the partners. Should be this week. It's been years making. I'm excited for that. So that's consuming a lot of my life right now. Getting into some travel. I'm going to be going to.
You think? I mean, you've been to three.
Through this month, or through February and March, I'm going to hit the top six cities in Canada. So I'm looking forward to that. I'm doing it in the winter too. And I'm all in. I'm hardcore. Edmonton even, right? Wow. Way up there. Yeah. But I love Canada, not just because of the coffee, but it's one of my favorite markets to support in North America. I love the whole world, but you know, I love going to Canada in particular. Mm-hmm. So got that coming up. Just got confirmation, a big Microsoft event. I'll be presenting at Experts Live in Asia in Singapore.
Fantastic.
In April. I'm taking all my Azure knowledge for storage and the security. Brad and I were talking a couple episodes ago about some blogging I've been doing at checkyourlogs.net on Azure storage and security. I'm going to take a lot of that into the lessons learned and hand that out to the attendees there. So that's a big milestone coming up. Looking forward to that. Other than that, nothing else is going on.
Very cool, my man. Very cool. Well, to everybody else, thanks, first of all, everybody who submitted questions this week. A couple really good ones. Really, really good ones. We always appreciate those. You can find Rick's information in the blog post, links to subscribe, and all that other good stuff. And we'll catch all of you right back here next time.